Thank you. Thank you very much, and good morning to you. I was at a conference the other day when one of the speakers began by saying, I don't know many of you here, so I've asked for a list of you all broken down by age and sex. But as I look at you all now, he said, I can see that most of you have actually been broken down by age and sex. Well, this is Greenbelt, so I would never begin a talk like that with you, of course. I'm here, of course, as you just heard, to talk about poetry and faith, to my mind, two inseparable topics. But I have to say it from the beginning. I know that for many people, poetry is a scary word because of bad memories of boredom or humiliation in school as you try to understand or recite and remember a poem. And maybe you've tried to come back to poetry later in life, but you don't quite know where to start. And when you did try and start, you found it all pretty incomprehensible. Too much work for too little result. There's even a word, by the way, metrophobia, the fear of poetry. Not fear of London transport, the fear of poetry, metrophobia. But I remember the day, very clearly, when I realised that my life needed more poetry in it. And I went to hear Wendy Cope read her poems, and towards the end of the reading, she read this very short poem called Names, and it's written about her grandmother. She was Eliza for a few weeks when she was a baby. Eliza Lily. Soon, it changed to Lil. Later, she was Miss Steward in the baker's shop. And then, my love, my darling, mother. Widowed at 30, she went back to work as Mrs. Hand. Her daughter grew up, married, and gave birth. Now, she was Nana. Everybody calls me Nana, she would say to visitors. And so they did. Friends, tradesmen, the doctor. In the geriatric ward, they used the patient's Christian names. Lil, we said. Or Nana. But it wasn't in her file. And for those last bewildered weeks, she was Eliza. Once again. I listened to those few simple lines that capture the fragile life cycle of a woman you feel tender towards just after 107 words. By the way, preachers out there, memo to self, you can do extraordinary things with just 107 words. You don't always need 107 points on an OHP. Just saying. Not all poems, of course, make you cry. Far from it. But what became clear to me that day and since is that when we're talking about poetry, I think we're talking about a soul language, a way of crafting words that distills your experience into what feels like purer truth. That's why I think when the Irish poet Michael Longley was asked, where do you get your poems from? All those words and images, where do they come from? He said, if I knew where poems came from, I'd go and live there. I've called my new book The Splash of Words because I think a good poem is like the pebble that you throw into a lake. There's that immediate splash, a little bit like the effect in here when I just finished reading names. There's the splash. And then the poem begins its work. The ripples set out towards your shore. Gentle, relentless, purposeful, and they begin to lap over the beach of your understanding. Shifting sands, unsettling your stones. And if you're a person like me who thinks theology at the end of the day is a sort of beachcombing exercise anyway, then the work of a poem brings things onto your shore that you might actually want to take and treasure. In the church, of course, we often like to think we're very good with our language, rather hip sometimes. That isn't always so. When I was in the north of London once, I saw a very big poster that simply asked passing shoppers, "Tired of sin? Then come in." To which someone had scribbled at the bottom, "But if not, telephone 642. But I don't need to tell you that for a person of faith, language matters. And whereas we can get very obsessed about being relevant, it seems to me that what we should be striving for more is resonance, more than relevance. I'm originally from Shropshire, and I was brought up as a child by my grandparents. And in Shropshire, there are a lot of sheep. And at the bottom of my grandparents' garden, about 3 years ago, I saw Tom. Tom's an old now shepherd in his early 80s. And one day I saw him in the field and he was carrying his shepherd's crook. And I called him over and I joked that my boss carried something a bit like that back in London. And we had a laugh and then I said, "Do you really use that thing to haul in naughty sheep? Is that what it's for?" And he laughed and he said, "No, Mark, I'll tell you what this is good for." He said, "I stick it into the ground so deep that I can hold on to it and keep myself so still that eventually the sheep learn to trust me." I can't tell you how I have wanted to preach at a bishop's consecration ever since that day. It's a really important image, though, not just for a bishop, but for a Christian and person of faith, drawing on the deeper place. It's called the humus. It's the root of our word humility. So that you can be so still, so centered, that you might actually, at the end of the day, be found worthy of some trust. And for that, you need a language worthy of the vocation. And I believe that language will be poetic. But let's just go back to the problem I started with for a moment, that you might be sitting there now feeling, okay, I can see where this is going, but I'm still a bit stuck on the poetry thing. I don't get it. If that's how you're thinking, then let me take you for a little trip this early morning. Let me take you to Belgium. Consider the way you'd be thinking now if you're planning a trip to go to Belgium. You might try to learn a few useful phrases, you'd be learning a bit of Belgian history, you'd be thumbing through a guidebook in search of museums, restaurants, flea markets. The important thing is you'd know that when you get to Belgium, at some point, you are going to be very confused, or at least occasionally at a loss. And you would accept that confusion just as being part of the fun of being abroad. What you wouldn't do is become paralyzed with anxiety because you're not fluent in Flemish, or that you have to understand really why the Belgium national symbol is a little boy peeing in a fountain. You would just say, actually, if I stick around here long enough, I'll probably get it eventually, but for the time being, I'm a bit at a loss, but isn't it fun? Well, think of poetry like that. The art form is enormous, perplexing, but you can amble. You can pause to have a nap. You can sample the dishes. And like all foreign countries, yes, poetry's got its rules and its customs, but you haven't got to remember them to make it worthwhile. What you do need is to book your ticket, to get the motivation, and you need a bit of patience on the journey. The point is that no matter how much you prepared for your trip, you know that at some point it is going to be confusing. But, and here I think is my spiritual point, number one, difficulty can be important. Look back at your life so far, and you'll probably see that the most important times were the difficult ones. As in life, so I believe in language. We're so used to quick answers, quick clarity, the seduction of the quick observation. For the spiritual journey, difficulty might be very important. A quick exercise. If I said to you now, here is the news, you would probably sit up and expect to hear some facts of the day, events that have occurred, some commentary on those facts. But instead, if I said to you now, once upon a time, you'd probably be equally expectant, maybe even a bit more expectant. But what you would do is you would tune in very differently. You'd be ready now to receive truth coming at you in a different form. Story, where meaning, of course, is communicated without summarizing it. Now, when you walk into a church or into a place of worship, how have you tuned in? Have you got your newsroom, your news at six ears on? Have you walked into a Google temple of facts on tap? Or have you walked into a poem? Have you walked into a space that is celebrating the fact that God will never be the object of our knowledge? God will always be the cause of our wonder. You see, to walk in with expectations of the one and to get the other might mean you miss something very vital. And it might mean that you get very frustrated or think the whole thing's bloody implausible. Category errors cause frustration. But religious faith is poetry plus, not science minus. So certainly in a Christian service, you have walked literally into poetry in motion. You stand and sing a poem, we call it a hymn or worship song. Then you'll hear an ancient poem, we call it a psalm. Then prayers full of images, metaphors, similes come along. If you're an Anglican priest, you'll stand there behind a table and talk about the silent music of your praise. The silent what? Silent music. I'll mention scripture in a moment. But if you're into higher styles, your gestures will become poetic. Your arms will go into the vocative, as a language is sought to praise the mystery of God, the reality of God. And you see, when a human being falls in love, and indeed, as I look around now, there may be one or two of you in here at the moment, hopelessly in love. I can see one or two flushed faces. I don't think it's your time of life. I think it may be that you're in love. But the fact is that when you fall in love, you're looking for a language that will express what you feel, and you will go to any length to describe the loved one. We all become poets as we scurry around to try to do some justice to their reality, to my feelings, to my perceptions. The fact is, poetry is the language of the lover, the language of love. And that, quite simply, is why it has to be the language of the church, the language of faith, as we scurry around, trying to do some justice with our words to the truth of God and the truth of ourselves. Because when you're in love, truth is far too important to be literalistic about. Now, just in case you think this is me getting a little bit carried away by the fact that I live rather near the South Bank, going a little bit Radio 4 here, a little bit too sort of I wandered lonely as a cannon. Let's just remember the ancient traditions of the great world faiths and the place poetry has in the heart of them all. The very earliest sacred texts of Hinduism, the Vedas, are in effect thousands of poems. The Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, Song of God, composed in verse. China, the classic Tao Te Ching, was written poetically in the 6th century before Christ, the opening verse referring to the gate to all mystery. Then the Hebrew Bible, full of poetic exploration, of course, the Psalms, that noble language of Job, the imagery of the Song of Songs, the riddles of the Proverbs, the prophets warning people what they've turned into and doing it through intense metaphor and imagery. They call us back to a vision with poetic hope, not with prosaic plan. Poetic hope is how the prophets want to transform. I'll come back to the Gospels in a moment, but jump to the Quran, where God is the poetic author of a text so beautiful that Muslims developed a particular chant style for reciting it. Listen to that much-repeated line that is the key statement of Islam's Shahada, or confession of faith. There is no God but God, in the Arabic transliterated as La ilaha illa Allah. It's like a little boat bobbing on the ocean of eternity, repeating that double consonant eel with the open A vowels gives it that rhythm and emphasis. In all these spiritual traditions, truth is expressed through poetry for the faithful. It isn't just a better way of saying truth. Truth comes in that form. The Christian Gospels are not so obviously poetic until, of course, you study them. You then see that the evangelists certainly had an artistry as they were writing their work, but you also meet Jesus Christ, who was persistently figurative in his preaching and teaching. Jesus, as it were, was always taking people on that journey to Belgium, leaving people often wondering, it says in the Gospels, what on earth he was on about, and yet being intrigued and drawn by this parabolic language that always hovers more than comes into land. It's the thing about the parables, they're hovering over you, never quite coming into touch. Jesus, of course, would never have scored that high in a seminary preaching class because there were rarely 3 points, and everybody was left wondering what he meant. Storytelling reveals meaning without committing the error of defining it. Storytelling was Jesus's first vocation. He was poetic. Here is something a bit shocking that you can take away and discuss over coffee. The Good Samaritan never existed, nor did the prodigal son. There was no Lazarus at the gate. The woman never lost a coin. Jesus made them up. He was a verbal artist. He used similes, metaphors, riddles all the time. And of course, when you get to the creeds, the Christian creeds, where have all those teachings gone? It's very difficult to paraphrase them. So when you recite your Apostles' Creed or your Nicene Creed, you hear that Jesus was born, he suffered, he died, he rose again, but I thought there was something in between. He taught. He was poetic. He defied dogma. One scholar, Joachim Jeremias, argued that the original Aramaic of Jesus' sayings would probably have been full of poetic alliteration and assonance in a 4-beat rhythm. But what we do know is that when he finished his poetry, as that splash took place, he said, "If you have the ears to hear, then hear." Might that be, have you tuned in right? This is not the news. This is the good news. And language has to go into a state of emergency to help us get to the kingdom. The prophet and poet in the Sufi tradition, Hafiz, described it as, you've got to pull out the chair beneath your mind to watch yourself just fall on God. So if you look at the heartland of the world's faiths and at the heartland of my own, the Christian way, then there is one conclusion. God is a poet. And that the tragedy is, and the troubles will always begin, when the people of faith become cursed with literalism, simmering down that richness, that ambiguity, that resonance into something hardened black and white, and then weaponized, biblical bullets you fire off. But nothing true can ever be said about God from a defensive posture, wrote Marilyn Robinson. But when you decide you want to control the poetry, to decide what it really means, then you will easily set yourself up against other people's insights and responses. And that dance that we have around the sacred flame will just peter out. And the language will become deadened and cheapened like so much language today. To put it succinctly, in the words of my poet friend who I met again last night, Padraic O'Tuma, whatever Jesus of Nazareth's death means, it doesn't mean something that can ever be written on a fridge magnet. The early theologian John Chrysostom said that when you read the scriptures, you shouldn't hammer away at a little word or a little phrase, hammering it to death. You should always read the scriptures, he says, like a letter from a friend. Read the love between the lines. And any interpretation of the scriptures where you cannot hear the love between the lines is not an interpretation to pursue. Having the poetic ear helps you read the love between the lines, not only of the Bible, but of your own life. And that's what I want to finish with. What does poetry have ultimately to do with my life, my discipleship? If I try to get to the heart of my own belief, I think it's something like this. God has given everyone in this tent a great gift. It is your being. We are all asked to give one gift back in return. It's called our becoming. What we become in that life. Put it another way, God loves us just as we are. God loves us so much, he doesn't want us to stay like that. And if you read the Gospels, you are endlessly discovering that Jesus meets people, he sees straight away where their little hardened full stop is in their life. We've all got them, somewhere where we've closed down, little full stop. He sees it and he turns it into a comma. Stand up. Walk. Ignore what they're saying. What is your name? Where's your full stop? Here's the comma. Begin again. You need a language, therefore, that is not so much about information, religion as information, as a language for formation, helping you become. We need, and I'm sure the teachings of Jesus do this, a language that is not setting out to answer all our questions so much as to question all our answers. We need a language that enlarges the heart, the mind, the humane, our understanding of the divine. Now, what we're more used to is prose. You know, prose, you sort of start here and you go along little chugs. Stop. Begin again. And you're catching up. And it's either making meaning or it isn't. Prose beginning with a capital letter. Chug, 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 chug. Full stop. It either communicated or it didn't. Poetry doesn't chug. This is language where relationships have come into play between the space and the text. This is language, but not as we know it. Gaps appear, dashes pop up, punctuation sometimes disappears. No single view in mind, but multiple insights, all riotously in dance with one another. You have to come out of your prosaic world in order to encounter it properly. And of course, the best thing to do with poetry, if you're stuck, is to read it out aloud, even when you're by yourself. You're going to feel a bit stupid, but try it. Because, of course, meaning and melody are often inseparable. We forget that, but if I said to you, hurry up, or slow down, hear how the meaning and the sounds collide. Hurry up, slow down. And of course, poetry is natural to us, and you have to come back to yourself in order to discover that. But you are a rhythm machine. You are walking around, hopefully all day, with one going off in your body all the time. Titum, titum, titum. If you want to be posh, we call it an iamb. Titum, titum, titum. Take one breath. How many iambs can you get in one breath? Titum, 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 titum. Five. Oh, let's call it iambic pentameter. It is the naturalest thing human beings can do, to breathe five titums with the heartbeat. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? So poetry, finally, is not some easy running river. It's not a quick read. It's not a stream, it is a fountain, a source which you patiently draw from. There's no quick clarity, there's no seductive easy answers, there's no one meaning to be had, no conclusive evidence to give to the court. Get a group of people talking about a poem and you'll discover that very quickly. You have to persevere for the meanings that begin to work their way out, resonating and demanding. And this is where faith and poetry collide. Poetry and faith both will always challenge your first impressions. Because if you ever live in a world of just first impressions, you are only half alive. It's a language of attentiveness. Glyn Maxwell, in that lovely book he's just brought out on poetry, says in poetry you need two things. You need a white space, a page or screen. He said, this is a bit like the snow and the ice of humanity. It's cold out there. God's asking Adam and Eve, where are you? Where are you? And then you start to, like a finger in a frosted window or a pickaxe in the ice, you start putting on the pixels on the paper and you're trying to find what it is that matters about this being human and this search for the divine. You can't paraphrase poetry. You can try and outline themes, but you can't paraphrase it. Try and paraphrase those 107 words of Wendy Cope that I began with. But poems communicate somewhere deep within us before they're understood by us. And that's why I think they're transformative. This language of provocation and recognition feels very much to me like the language of the Holy Spirit. Provoking and recognizing, challenging and comforting. Transformative. And that's why poems will always be used when you're rehabilitating young offenders, when you're trying to give voice to unspoken grief at the funeral, helping children to see their world better, to stirring up adults to protest for change. Poetry is the more human voice. And the meanings of the poem are always ahead of us. Catch us if you can, catch us if I can. And we are following because it feels as if we're being taken somewhere very new. So my book is not scholarly, but it is enthusiastic. I look at some poems in it from my life of faith, and I hope to share something of what I encounter there. The medieval mystic Meister Eckhart once said, that God is rather, at the end of the day, like a person hiding in the dark who just occasionally coughs and gives himself away. I think poetry is where I hear the cough, where my own snoring through life is interrupted, where the splash makes me jump and freshens me and puzzles me, just like those words, follow me. It was my way, I suppose, writing the book, of trying to celebrate the truth that I believe really very deeply, that God is in this world as poetry is in the poem. So buy that ticket to Belgium. Thank you for listening.
Well, what an extraordinary introduction in the most poetic prose to poetry. We have about 20 minutes now for questions. I should just say at 10:45, immediately after this, Mark's going to be signing copies of the book in the bookstore just across the way. We're in partnership with the Church Times that runs that bookshop. So being a Greenbelt audience, I know you have double the number of questions that there are people in the room. So if you raise your hand, and we'll either get the mic to you, or you can come forward, or you know, you can boom forth in your own poetic prose. So let me see questions. Thanks very much. Would you like the mic, or can you?
Thank you, Mark, very much. As somebody who's never really got into poetry and has never understood it and has bit of a hang-up about it, I'm just wondering, I mean, I was really inspired by what you had to say, and it's whetted my appetite very much. I'm just wondering whether there's something about personality that's related to how easy we do or don't find poetry, and whether there are some of us who are more fluid and exploratory and creative, and some of us who are more sort of structured and focused and linear. Do you think that makes a difference and makes it easier for some to be more creative than others?
There may be something about how easy you find to get into the form. It's like some people will go around an art gallery and they'll say, what's that? What does it mean? And some people will say, will you shut up? You know, if we wanted to explain what it meant, you wouldn't have done the painting, okay? So there's always that dialogue. But my discovery, I think, certainly working in groups and going around churches and even did a deanery synod not long ago. Woo! It's life, but not as we know it, isn't it, the deanery synod? Where there was a lot of different personality types, is that they were being surprised by not being asked to be creative writers themselves, but they were learning that you could be a creative listener. And if you can do, I think we've all got that potential. You might need a bit of a tickling of the tummy like a trout to sort of get you out of it, but you can do it. And the best way to do it is to sit yourself in a little circle of friends, read the same poem, and say, you know, nobody's going to get anything wrong here. Let's just see what happens. And I guarantee you most people will start melting then. Try it. There's also a book, if you're very scientifically orientated and think this is all a load of bunkum, the lovely book called Poetry and Science by Mary Midgley that shows you how poetic scientists are. All those images that they come up for reality, they're fantastically poetic.
Thank you very much. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. I wondered, being provocative, whether you had any thoughts about the disreputable uses to which poetry can be put. We've just had World War I centenary last year, and we all think of Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon, the great sort of anti-war poets. But of course, there was a vast amount of pro-war poetry produced back then. Think of something like In Flanders fields, the poppies grow between the crosses, row on row. We are the dead, take up the fight, you know, and that kind of, you know, we forget because we have a revisionist view of history, that the vast majority of poetry produced at that time was banging the drum.
All good things can be put to bad use. That's the history of humanity. Poetry is no different. I would just say you have to use your ear to discern what is poetry from polemic. And authentic poetry will never be polemic. But people will try and make it. And there is a thing called bad poetry. you know, there's bad music. There's, you know, but yeah, I agree with you. But, of course, as you've just said, the other poets were also at work. And which ones last? Which ones last? I think we know the answer to that.
Sorry. Hi. Firstly, I'd like to say thanks. I heard your talk at the PCN conference about poetry, and as a direct result, I started introducing poetry to the social work course I teach on, and we now have poetry on the corridors, and Benjamin Zephaniah and Wendy Cope. So it was the direct result of your inspiration on that, so thank you. And my question is, I go to a traditional Anglican church, and they do three readings, and most of the time I go, I think, oh, I'm a bit bored by the three readings, maybe one, and couldn't they just have a poem? Do you know any churches using poetry like that, or is there some Anglican rule that says you can't?
An Anglican rule. I was just saying earlier that my experience of the Church of England is that it has the engine of a lawnmower and the brakes of a juggernaut, and my friend here said no, the engine of a hairdryer, actually. But yes, it does feel sometimes there's a lot of blockades to doing something imaginative. There are lots of churches out there that are breaking out of formality, because of course quite often the dialogue that you can set up between a scriptural text and a poem is fantastic. And often you don't need to preach a very long sermon, or any sermon, actually, if you do it well. So yes, come up with a suggestion. Try it out. See whether they like it. If, of course, people are a bit nervous about breaking the liturgy up into something that's going to feel a little bit too flexy, get a parish poetry group going. Start small, but people will be drawn to it. And they'll probably be freer to express the things that they believe in that setting quite often than they will over coffee after the liturgy. So a poetry group might be a good step forward. And great to hear about the development. Thank you.
Thank you. Just in response to that, we always have a psalm. So it may be worth looking at the reading of the psalm, because they are poetry. And if they are read well, they are equally as beautiful and as accessible as any modern poems. I'm a preacher, and I like to use poems in my preaching. Sometimes I just kind of drop them in, and other times I have to be careful not to give a kind of poetry class on them, because I used to be a teacher. So I was just wondering if you have suggestions for bringing poetry into preaching.
Yes, you've got to be a bit careful, because, as I was discovering earlier, to read a poem, particularly if you're in a booming building, or you've got one of these that keeps going all the time, it's quite difficult, isn't it, to get the intimacy of a poetry. The thing about poetry, a bit like God, is that it's full of immense intimacy and intimate immensity, if I can put it that way. So it's quite difficult to help people tune in. What you can do is print it and say in the sermon, I'm now going to read this poem, and allow people to look at it as well, so that that helps sometimes. What doesn't often work is when you say, I'm now going to read 15 pages of Kubla Khan, and please do settle down. I mean, that I think that's the way to give people, you know, and set them off into a coma. But I think, yes, you can. And what I also encourage people is to not just to recite poems and use poems, but to be poetic. Because if we're following Jesus Christ, those stories that hovered, don't be afraid, preachers, of not coming up with the answers or conclusions or summaries. Because Jesus rarely did it. He just let it hover. And so your language can afford to be, a little bit ambiguous. Well, wouldn't that be refreshing, you know? And anyway, at the end of the day, if 60 people are listening to your sermon, there are 60 different sermons being heard, and not one of them is the one you're giving.
Thanks. Sorry, I've got so many things going around in my head. But you drew a distinction between the prosaic, literalistic prose and the poetic. And it seems to me that applies right the way across life, not just with language. And it seems that we live our lives mostly in prose, and therefore poetry is therefore sometimes outside of our lives and needs to be more integrated. And sort of alongside that, I wondered that how much the linguistic rules of poetry, and a lot of people's, mine included, lack of understanding of them, limit us, and how important those rules are into that altering the prosaic into the poetic. And now I've lost my train of thought.
I'm not sure how prosaic we are today. I think we're more bumper sticker. I feel we live, theology is getting a bit like this, honk if you like my theology that I've summarized in a sentence and drive by if you don't. That sort of cheapened, sloganized language is very dangerous. And of course, we're seeing it used by politicians on both sides of the Atlantic at the moment. So yes, we are used to the prosaic. I would just say that the rules are less important than the poetry. So you may start reading your poetry and eventually say, this is quite extraordinary. How do they do it? Then you might start reading a little bit about the customs and the regulations. But actually, remember Belgium, just go and enjoy Belgium. Scratch your head occasionally, and then one day you might say, what are the driving laws in Bruges? Let's go and have a look at that. Meanwhile, I've been quite enjoying driving along. So I would say don't get too rule-bound. Just enjoy it first of all and then splash about a bit later.
Thank you, Mark. I enjoy that very much, not just having lived for 5 years in Belgium. I think for many of us brought up in a more traditional doctrinal approach in what Richard Rohr calls the first half of life, are discovering much more the poetic, the expressive, in what he then calls the second half of life. But I've one serious question about your biblical summary, and there's a lot of excellent stuff there. You talked about Jesus speaking in parables, speaking metaphorically, and so on. But the gospel writers and the epistle writers wrote largely in prose. Have they somehow traduced or limited or circumscribed the master?
Letters, of course, are letters and shouldn't be read as anything else but, it seems to me. When you say a reading from the letter, I mean, you've actually opened somebody's drawer and started to read their letters. So the first thing to remember is they are that. But read those letters. They are enormously poetic. There is Paul trying to work out what this in Christ might mean, or what this church, this ecclesia is. And he turns every which way to find metaphors, similes, colliding images to do some justice to it. So although we can read it doctrinally, go back to the letter where he's trying impassionately to tell his friends that he's left and he's longing for, about what his understanding is and what he's been thinking about while he's been bobbing about on that boat, about who they are, and you'll see that he was poetically stretching. His contours were always expanding. And that, for me, is just proof of the pudding. But we can read it as if we're all little New Testament scholars who love Bultmann. And actually, I would say no, go back to the origin, to the source of it, and you'll find something much more exciting. Paul was on a spiritual adventure, and his mind was always expanding, and he needed a language that would catch up. So that's exactly really what I'm trying to say about all of us.
Hi, thanks very much. My question is sort of following on from that one. I'm wondering what you make of the law in Scripture, because I think we often sort of contrast legalistic understandings with poetic understandings, and yet Jesus does say he's come to fulfill the law. So I'm wondering what you make of that.
I don't see any conflict, really. I think that Jesus upheld the law, and then he told stories to show how you ought to be pragmatic. So if you find somebody in a ditch, then, and it happens to be the Sabbath, then for heaven's sake, know what the right thing to do is. And how am I going to break that law in your mind that you know you can't do that? I'm going to tell you a story, and then you'll see.
Just in response to your comment about poetry in churches, I attend an Anglican church, St. Luke's, in West Holloway in London, and we usually incorporate poetry within our service most Sundays. I wanted to ask a little bit more about, I'm always intrigued about bad poetry or bad music or bad art. I'm a poet myself, and I always struggle whether there is such a thing. And I guess one definition I try and put on it is, by the words that are written, do they somehow have an impact or change either the person writing them or the hearer of the words? So I think for me that's a definition. So what might appear bad poetry, if it's transformative in some way, isn't. I'd just appreciate your further comments.
For me, the answer is kitsch. If you're reading a poem and before you've finished it, you know what the next line is going to be, it's bad poetry. If there's a splash still, if there's something unexpected, if there's some movement that you haven't quite imagined might happen, it's poetry. So for me, it's about the almost having low expectations of the next line. You know it ain't good. Somebody once said, how do you know if it's, you know, if it's good or bad poetry? And they said it's a bit like fish. If it's fresh, it's good. If it's bad, it stinks. And if you don't know, try it out on the cat.
Thank you for that. As a recovering evangelical, I really appreciate that. But we live in a very visual age, so I'm just wondering, does poetry need to adapt or adjust to those kind of pressures? And if I listen to rap music, is that listening to poetry, or is that just bad poetry?
On the visual thing, it's fascinating to me how a lot of galleries now are doing poetry and poet and artist dialogues, and I'm doing something in October at the National Gallery where they've asked me to look at poetry with paintings. So there is that dialogue, I think, is certainly in the air, and a lot of poets are responding to visual art all the time in their work, and I don't think one's better than the other. It's just that for me, this is what's, you know, chugging my boat at the moment. So what was your other question? Oh, the rap music. No, I think poetry comes in lots of guises, and modern poetry is being rapped and put on walls in graffiti. I'm not Wordsworthian about this. I'm not going around in a floppy hat saying, you know, darling, it's got to be like this. I think it's raw. Poetry is raw. And I think a lot of it will be found in people who are motivating. You'll hear it around here, lots of poetry going on in speeches, motivating people to rise up and cause change. I often remind people, Martin Luther King never once said, I have a nightmare. He said, I have a dream. And then he told you what the dream was. And I think Jesus did the same. I have a kingdom. Okay. What won't work is if you just become prosaic and full of plans. And so the rap and the graffiti, and I mean, we've got some young poets coming to St. Paul's, performing poets who are going to perform their poetry in St. Paul's for exactly this reason. I don't quite know what they're going to do. I'm a bit scared. I think it will be a great evening. For that exact reason. So I don't want to be terribly sort of effete about it. I think good poetry is fresh. and that means it can be found in lots of very unexpected places.
I was wondering what you would say to the criticism that poetry is a kind of bourgeois luxury for those with the time and the space to devote to it. But for our law makers, the state of our theological disputes is sufficiently impatient that it can only affect a kind of rolling of the eyes.
I think Canon Oakley in his time has caused a few rolling eyes in synods. I think you could write it off, like any art, as a bourgeois preoccupation. I would just say, remember all those places I was talking about where it is used not to be a feat and show off, but to actually help change people's lives and to help their recognitions to discover their self that's been blocked by their background or whatever. I think the fantastic thing about poetry is not when somebody gets up like this and starts talking about it, but actually when you go to, and you were talking about it earlier, when you go to places where it's actually helping to change people's worldviews and situations. There will always be people who prefer paper clips and pens and memos, and we need them. But we will also always need in the church people who will say, at the end of the day, God is in the world as poetry is in the poem. And we need a language that celebrates that and not pins God down like a dead moth. You need a poetry that's always risky and ready to say, I may have got that wrong, let's move on. There'll always be that debate. But when you have a church where one of them is getting eclipsed, watch out.
Hello, I'm a vicar in a small Wiltshire town, and one of the headaches of the year and also the joys and responsibilities is taking the remembrance service. And last year I was criticised for not respecting enough the obedience shown by soldiers when they go to war and concentrating too much on peace. Have you any guidance or thoughts how I might use poetry to recognise the pain that the soldiers and their families have gone through, but also move us on and celebrate where we are now because of what they've done?
We have a chat afterwards because I think there are lots of resources around. I would also say don't always feel you've got to go back to the First World War. There are people who are grieving at the moment who are getting rid of their grief by writing poetry, as spouses and partners of people who've been killed recently, and that's also around. The other thing, I was recently in the States. In fact, I wrote this on sabbatical in the States. And I stayed for a while with a friend of mine, Bishop Gene Robinson, for a couple of days. And he'd just been to Ferguson, where there'd been the shooting of the black guy, and Black Lives Matter were assembling. And as he walked around, he saw an enormous box, brown paper box, and on it, beautifully inscribed in a marker pen, were words that had been put there in memory of this guy. And it simply said, they tried to bury us, but they forgot that we are seeds. They tried to bury us, but they forgot that we are seeds. And he was so struck by this, he went back, where are these words from? And he suddenly discovered that a Mexican group of liberationists had used these words. And he said, but that's weird, you know. So we've now got a black community protesting against death of innocent people using them on cardboard. And it was used in the 70s in Mexico. But then he discovered it actually came from a gay Greek poet in the 60s who was being isolated from his literary community. And he wrote, they tried to bury me, they forgot I am a seed. And here was this one line of a poet being used to counter movements that tried to suppress. I don't think that's bourgeois. I think that's pretty exciting.
Well, some fantastic questions after an absolutely beautiful talk by Mark. Shelley once referred to poets as the unacknowledged legislators of the world. It's a big statement, but perhaps today we've heard ways in which we might think that poets need to be more acknowledged and more part of our prosaic lives. Please join me one more time in thanking Mark.